And yet he, too, did not know what happened to Hiroko. We didn't see the police take any of them away, he said. But we didn't find Hiroko and her group down here, either, after things had calmed down. We don't know where they went. He tugged at his turquoise earring, obviously mystified. I think they are probably off on their own. Hiroko was always careful to have a bolt hole everywhere she went. That is what Iwao told me once when we drank a lot of sake down at the duck pond. And it seems to me that disappearance is a habit of Hiroko's, but not of the transitional authority. So we can infer that she chose to do this. But come on, you must want a bath and some food, and then if you could talk to some of the Sansei and Yonsei who have gone into hiding with us, that would be good for them. So they stayed in the maze for a week or two, and Maya met with several groups of the newly disappeared. She spent most of her time encouraging them, assuring them that they would be able to reemerge onto the surface, even into Sabishi itself, quite soon. Security was hardening, but the nets were simply too permeable, and the alternative economy too large to allow for total control. Switzerland would give them new passports, Praxis would give them jobs, and they would be back in business. The important thing was to coordinate their efforts and to resist the temptation to lash out too early. Nano told her after one such meeting that Nadia was making similar appeals in South Fossa and that Sachs's team was begging them for more time, so there was some agreement on the policy, at least among the old-timers. And Nirgal was working closely with Nadia, supporting the policy as well. So it was the more radical groups that they would have to work hardest to rein in, and here Coyote had the most influence. He wanted to visit some of the Red refuges in person, and Maya and Michelle went with him to catch a ride up to Burrows. The region between Sabishi and Burrows was saturated with crater impacts, so that they wound through the nights between flat-topped circular hills, stopping every dawn at small rim shelters crowded with Reds who were none too hospitable to Maya and Michelle. But they listened to Coyote very attentively and traded news with him about scores of places Maya had never heard of. On the third night of this, they came down the steep slope of the great escarpment through an archipelago of Mesa Islands and abruptly onto the smooth plain of Isidus. They could see down the slope of the basin for a long way, all the way out to where a mound like the Sabishian's Moho Mound ran across the land. In a great curve from Dumarthurey Crater on the Great Escarpment, northwest towards Syrtis. This was the new dike, Coyote told them, built by a robot collection pulled from the Elysium Mohole. The dike was truly massive and looked like one of the basalt dorsa of the south, except that its velvety texture revealed it to be excavated regolith rather than hard volcanic rock. Maya stared at the long ridge. The cascading recombinant consequences of their actions were, she thought, out of their control. They could try to build bulwarks to contain them, but would the bulwarks hold? Then they were back in Burrows, in through the southeast gate on their Swiss IDs, and secured in a safe house run by Bogdanovists from Vishniak, now working for Praxis. The safe house was an airy, light-filled apartment about halfway up the northern wall of Hunt Mesa, with a view out over the central valley to Branch Mesa and Double-Decker Butte. The apartment above it was a dance studio, and many hours of the day they lived to a faint thump, 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 thump. Just over the horizon to the north, an irregular cloud of dust and steam marked where the robots were working still on the dike. Every morning Maya looked out at it, thinking over the news reports on Mangalavid and in the long messages from Praxis. Then it was into the day's work, which was entirely underground, and often confined to meetings in the apartment or to work there on video messages. So it was not at all like life in Odessa, and it was hard to develop any habits which made her feel jangly and dark. But she could still walk the streets of the great city, one anonymous citizen among thousands of others, strolling by the canal or sitting in restaurants around Princess Park or on one of the less trendy mesa tops. And everywhere she went, she saw the neat red print of their stenciled graffiti, "Free Mars or Get Ready." Or, as if she were hallucinating a warning made to her by her own soul, "You can never go back." These messages were ignored by the populace as far as she could tell, never discussed, and often removed by cleaning crews, but they kept popping up in their neat red, usually in English, but sometimes in Russian, the old alphabet, like a long-lost friend, like some subliminal flash out of their collective unconscious, if they had one. And somehow the messages never lost their little electric shock. It was strange what powerful effects could be created with such simple means. People might come to do almost anything if they talked about it long enough. Her meetings with small cells of the various resistance organizations went well, although it became clearer to her that there were profound divisions of all kinds among them, particularly the dislike that the Reds and Mars Firsters had for the Bogdanovists and Free Mars groups, whom the Reds considered green, and thus one more manifestation of the enemy. That could be trouble. But Maya did what she could, and everyone at least listened to her, so that she felt she made some progress. And slowly she warmed to Burroughs and her hidden life there. Michelle arranged a routine for her with the Swiss and Praxis, and with the Bogdanovists now tucked away in the city, a secure routine which allowed her to meet groups fairly frequently without ever compromising the integrity of the safe houses they had established. And every meeting seemed to help a little. The only intransigent problem was that so many groups seemed to want to revolt immediately. Red or green, they tended to follow the radical lead of Anne's Reds in the Outback and the young hotheads surrounding Jackie, and there were more and more incidents of sabotage in the cities, which caused a corresponding increase in police surveillance, until it seemed very possible that things could break wide open. Maya began to see herself as a kind of break, and she often lost sleep worrying about how little people wanted to hear that message. On the other hand, she was also the one who had to keep the old Bogdanovists and other veterans aware of the power of the native movement, cheering them up when they got depressed. Anne in the Outback with the Reds, grimly wrecking stations. "It's not going to happen like that," Maya told her over and over, though there was no sign that Anne was getting the message. Still, there were encouraging signs. Nadia was in South Fossa building a strong movement there which seemed under her influence, and closely aligned with Nirgal and his crowd. Vlad and Ursula and Marina had reoccupied their old labs at Acheron under the aegis of the Praxis Bioengineering Company, nominally in charge. They were in constant communication with Sachs, who was in a refuge in Da Vinci Crater with his old terraforming team, being supported by the Dorsa Brevia Minoans. The inhabitation of that great lava tube had extended north much farther than it had been during the time of the Congress, and most of the new segments apparently were devoted to shelter for the refugees from the wrecked or abandoned sanctuaries farther south, and a whole string of manufactories. Maya watched videos of people driving about in little cars from segment to tented segment, working under the clear brown light pouring down from the filtered skylights, engaged in what could only be called military production. They were building stealth flyers, stealth cars, surface-to-space missiles, reinforced block shelters, some of which were already installed in the lava tube itself in case it was ever broached, also air-to-ground missiles, anti-vehicle weapons, handguns, and, the Minoans told Maya, a variety of ecological weapons Sachs was designing himself. This kind of work, and the destruction of the southern sanctuaries, had created what looked from a distance like a sort of war fever in Dorsa Brevia, and Maya was worried by that, too. Sachs, at the heart of it, was a stubborn, secretive, brilliant, brain-damaged loose cannon, a bona fide mad scientist. He had still never spoken to her directly, and his strikes against the aerial lens and Daimos, while very effective, had, in her opinion, caused UNTA's intensification of the assault on the South. She kept sending down messages advising restraint and patience until Ariadne replied irritably, "Maya, we know. We're working with Sachs here. We've got an idea of what we're up to, and what you're saying is either obvious or wrong. Talk to the Reds if you want to help, but we don't need it." Maya cursed the video and talked to Spencer about it. Spencer said, "Sachs thinks if we're going to pull this off, we might need some weapons, if only in reserve. It seems sensible to me." "What happened to the idea of a decapitation?" "Maybe he thinks he's building the guillotine. Look, talk to Nergal and Art about that, or even Jackie."
"Right.
Look, I want to talk to Sachs. He's got to talk to me sometime, goddammit. Get him to talk to me, will you?" Spencer agreed to try, and one morning he arranged a call over his private line to Sachs. It was Art who answered the call, but he promised to try to get Sachs to come to the line.
"He's busy these days, Maya. I like to see it. People are calling him General Sachs."
"God forbid."
"That's all right. They talk about General Nadia, too, and General Maya."
"That's not what they call me."
"The Black Widow, more like, or the bitch, the killer."
She knew.
And Art's squint told her she was right.
"Well," he said, "whatever. With Sachs, it's kind of a joke. People talk about the revenge of the lab rats, that kind of thing."
"I don't like it."
The idea of another revolution seemed to be gaining a life of its own now, a momentum independent of any real logic. It was just something they were doing, were always going to have done. Out of her control and out of anyone's control. Even their collective efforts, scattered and hidden as they were, seemed not to be coordinated or conceived with any clear idea of what they were going to try to do or why. It was just happening. She tried to express some of this to Art, and he nodded.
"That's history, I guess. It's messy. You just have to ride the tiger and hold on. You've got a lot of different people in this movement, and they all have their own ideas. But look, I think we're doing better than last time. I'm working on some initiatives back on Earth, negotiating with Switzerland and some people at the World Court and so on, and Praxis is keeping us really well informed about what's going on among the metanationals on Earth, which means we won't just get swept into something we don't understand."
"True," Maya admitted.
The news and analysis packages sent up from Praxis were more thorough by far than any commercial news shows, and as the metanationals continued to drift into what was being called the metanatricide, they on Mars, in their sanctuaries and safe houses, were able to follow it blow by blow. Tsubarashi taking over Mitsubishi, and then its old foe Arms Corps, and then falling out with Amex, which was working hard on breaking the United States out of the Group of 11. They saw it all from the inside. Nothing could have been less like the situation in the 2050s, and that was a comfort, if a very small one. And then there was Sachs on the screen behind Art, and looking at her. He saw who it was and said, "Maya!" She swallowed hard. She was forgiven then for Phyllis? Did he understand why she had done it? His new face gave her no clues. It was as impassive as his old one had been, and harder to read because so unfamiliar still. She collected herself, asked him what his plans were. He said,
"No plan. We're still making preparations. We need to wait for a trigger event, very important. There are a couple of possibilities I'm keeping an eye against, but nothing yet."
"Fine," she said, "but listen, Sachs."
And then she told him everything she had been worrying about. The strength of the transitional authority troops, bolstered as they were by the big centrist metanats. The constant edging toward violence in the more radical wings of the underground. The feeling that they were falling into the same old pattern. And as she spoke, he blinked in his old fashion, so that she knew it was really him listening under that new face, finally listening to her again, so that she went on longer than she had intended to, pouring out everything, her distrust of Jackie, her fear of being in Burroughs, everything. It was like talking to a confessor, or pleading, begging their pure rational scientist not to let things go crazy again, not to go crazy again himself. She heard herself babbling and realized how frightened she was. And he blinked in what seemed a kind of neuter, rat-like sympathy. But in the end, he shrugged and said little. This was General Sachs now, remote, taciturn, speaking to her from the strange world inside his new mind. "Give me 12 months," he said to her. "I need 12 more months. "Okay, Sax." She felt reassured somehow. "I'll do my best." "Thanks, Maya." And he was gone. She sat there staring at the little AI screen, feeling drained, teary, relieved, absolved for the hour. So she returned to the work with a will, meeting groups almost every week and making occasional off-the-net trips to Elysium and Tharsis to talk to cells in the high cities. Coyote took charge of her travel, flying her across the planet in night voyages that reminded her of 61. Michelle took charge of her security, protecting her with the help of a team of natives, including several of the zygote ectogenes, who moved her from safe house to safe house in every city they visited. And she talked and talked and talked. It wasn't just a matter of getting them to wait, but also coordinating them, forcing them to agree they were on the same side. Sometimes it seemed that she was having an effect. She could see it on the faces of the people who came to listen. Other times her whole effort was devoted to applying the brakes, worn, burning, to radical elements. There were a lot of these now, and more every day. Anne and the Reds, Casse's Mars Firsters, the Bogdanovists under Mikhail, Jackie's Boonians, the Arab radicals led by Antar, who was one of Jackie's many boyfriends, Coyote, Dow, Rachel. It was like trying to stop an avalanche that she herself was caught up in, grasping at clumps even as she rolled down with them. In such a situation, the disappearance of Hiroko began to loom as more and more of a disaster. The attacks of deja vu returned, stronger than ever. She had lived in Burroughs before, in a time like this. Perhaps that was all it was. But the feeling was so disturbing when it struck, this profound, unshakable conviction that everything had happened before in exactly this way, as ineluctably as if eternal recurrence were really true. So that she would wake up and go to the bathroom, and certainly all that had happened before in just that way, including all the stiffness and small aches and pains. And then she would walk out to meet with Nergal and some of his friends and recognize that it was a genuine attack and not just a coincidence. Everything had happened just like this before. It was all clockwork, strokes of fate. Okay, she would think, ignore it. That's reality, then. We are creatures of fate. At least you don't know what will happen next. She talked endlessly with Nergal, trying to understand him and get him to understand her. She learned from him, she imitated him in meetings now. His bright, friendly, quiet confidence which so obviously drew people to him. They were both famous. They both were talked about on the news. They both were on UNTA's wanted list. They both had to stay off the streets now. So they had a bond, and she learned all she could from him, and she thought he learned from her as well. She had an influence, anyway. It was a good relationship, her best link to the young. He made her happy. He gave her hope. But to have it all happen in the remorseless grip of an overmastering fate. The scene again, the always already. Nothing but brain chemistry, Michelle said. There was simply a neural delay or repetition which was giving her the sensation that the present was a kind of past as well, as maybe it was. So she accepted his diagnosis and took whatever drugs he prescribed without complaint and without hope. Every morning and evening she opened the pocket in the container strip he prepared for her every week and took whatever pills were in it without asking questions. She didn't lash out at him. She no longer felt the urge. Perhaps the night of the vigil in Odessa had cured her. Perhaps he had finally mixed the right cocktail of drugs. She hoped so. She went out with Nergal to meetings, returned to the apartment under the dance studio exhausted, and yet very often insomniac. Her health got bad. She was sick often. Digestive troubles, sciatica, chest pains. Ursula recommended another course of the gerontological treatment. Always helps, she said. And with the latest genomic mismatch scanning techniques faster than ever. She would only have to take a week off at most, but Maya didn't feel like she had a week to take off. Later, she told Ursula, when this is all over. Some nights when she couldn't sleep, she read about Frank. She had taken the photo from the Odessa apartment with her, and now it was stuck to the wall by her bed in the Hunt Mesa safe house. She still felt the pressure of that electrifying gaze, and so sometimes in the sleepless hours she read about him and tried to learn more about his diplomatic efforts. She hoped to find things he had been good at to imitate, and also to identify what he had done that she thought had been wrong. One night in the apartment after a tense visit to Sabishi and the community still hidden in its mound maze, she fell asleep over her lectern which had been displaying a book about Frank. Then a dream about him woke her. Restlessly, she went out to the living room of the apartment and got a drink of water and went back and began to read the book again. This one focused on the years between the Treaty Conference of 2057 and the outbreak of the unrest in 2061. These were the years when Maya had been closest to him, but she remembered them poorly, as if by flashes of lightning, moments of electric intensity separated by long stretches of pure darkness. And the account in this particular book sparked no feelings of recognition in her at all, despite that fact that she was mentioned fairly frequently in the text. A kind of historical jamais vu. Coyote was sleeping on the couch, and he groaned in some dream of his own and woke and looked around to find the source of the light. He padded behind her on the way to the bathroom, looked over her shoulder. "Ah," he said meaningfully, "they say a lot about him." And he went down the hall. When he came back, Maya said, "I suppose you know better." "I know some things about Frank that they don't, that's for sure." Maya stared at him. "Don't tell me. You were in Nicosia, too." Then she remembered reading that somewhere. "I was, now you mention it." He sat down heavily on his couch, stared at the floor. "I saw Frank that night, throwing bricks through windows. He started that riot single-handed." He looked up, met her stare. "He was speaking to Selim El Heil in the Apex Park about a half hour before John was attacked. You figure it out for yourself." Maya clenched her teeth and stared at the lectern, ignoring him. He stretched out on the couch and began to snore. It was old news, really. And as Zeke had made clear, no one would ever untangle that knot, no matter what they had seen or thought they remembered seeing. No one could be sure of anything that far in the past, not even of their own memories, which shifted subtly at every rehearsal. The only memories one could trust were those unbidden eruptions from the depths, the mémoires involontaires, which were so vivid they had to be true, but often concerned unimportant events. No. Coyotes was just one more unreliable account among all the rest. When the words of the text on the screen started registering again, she read on. Chalmers's efforts to stop the outbreak of violence in 2061 were unsuccessful because in the end he was simply ignorant of the full extent of the problem. Like most of the rest of the first 100, he could never quite imagine the actual population of Mars in the 2050s, which was well over 1 million. And while he thought that the resistance was led and coordinated by Arkady Bogdanov because he knew him, he was unaware of the influence of Oskar Schnelling in Korolyov, or of the widespread Red movements such as Free Elysium, or the unnamed Disappeareds who left the established settlements by the hundreds. Through ignorance and a failure of the imagination, he addressed only a small fraction of the problem. Maya pulled back, stretched, looked over at Coyote. Was that really true? She tried to think back into those years to remember. Frank had been aware, hadn't he? Playing with needles when the roots are sick. Hadn't Frank said that to her sometime in that period? She couldn't remember. Playing with needles when the roots are sick. The statement hung there, separated from anything else, from any context that could give it meaning. But she had the very strong impression that Frank had been aware that there was a huge, unseen pool of resentment and resistance out there. No one had been more aware of it, in fact. How could this writer have missed that? For that matter, how could any historian, sitting in a chair and sifting through the records, ever know what they had known, ever capture the way it had felt at the time, the fractured kaleidoscopic nature of the daily crisis, each moment of the storm they had struggled? She tried to remember Frank's face, and there came to her an image of him hunched over miserably at a cafe table, a white coffee cup handle spinning under his feet. And she had broken the coffee cup. But why? She couldn't remember. She clicked forward through the book on the screen, flying through months with every paragraph, the dry analysis utterly divorced from anything like what she could recall. Then a sentence caught her eye, and she read on as if a hand were at her throat, forcing her to. Ever after their first liaison in Antarctica, Toitevna had a hold over Chalmers that he never broke, no matter how much it damaged his own plans. Thus, when he returned from Elysium in the final month before the unrest broke out, Toitevna met him in Burrows, and they stayed together for a week, during which it was clear to others they were fighting. Chalmers wanted to stay in Burrows, where the conflict was at a crisis. Toitevna wanted him to return to Sheffield. One night he showed up in one of the cafes by the canal so angry and distraught that the waiters were afraid, and when Toitevna appeared, they expected him to explode. But he only sat there as she reminded him of every connection they had ever had, every debt owed, all their past together, such as it was. And finally he bowed to her wishes and returned to Sheffield, where he was unable to control the growing violence in Elysium and Burrows. And so the revolution came. Maya stared at the screen. It was wrong, wrong, wrong. All wrong. Nothing like that had happened. A liaison in Antarctica? No, never. But she had once confronted him at some restaurant,
No doubt it was possible they had been observed, so hard to say. But this book was stupid, stuffed with unwarranted speculation, not history at all. Or maybe all the histories would be like that if one had really been there and so could judge them properly. All lies. She tried to call it back. She clenched her teeth and stiffened, and her fingers curled as if she could dig out thoughts with them. But it was like clawing at rock. And now when she tried to remember that particular confrontation in a cafe, no visual image at all came into her mind. The phrases from the book overlaid them. She reminded him of every connection they had ever had. No! No! A figure hunched at a table. There it was, the image itself. And it finally looked up at her. But it was the youthful face from her kitchen wall in Odessa. She groaned. She began to cry. She chewed at her clenched fists and wept. "You okay?" Coyote said blearily from the couch. "No." "Find something?" "No." Frank was being erased by books and by time. The years had passed, and for her, even for her, Frank Chalmers was becoming nothing but one tiny historical figure among many others, standing out there like a person seen through the wrong end of the telescope. A name in a book. Someone to read about, along with Bismarck, Talleyrand, Machiavelli. And her Frank. Gone. She spent a few hours of most days going over the Praxis reports with Art, trying to find patterns and comprehend them. They were getting such great amounts of data through Praxis that they had the reverse of the problem they had had in the pre-61 crisis. Not too little information, but too much. Every day the screws tightened in a multitude of crises, and Maya often ended up near despair. Several countries attending the UN, all of them consolidated or Subarashi clients, requested that the World Court be abolished, as its functions were redundant. Most of the Metanats immediately declared their support for this idea, and as the World Court had long ago begun as an agency of the UN, there were those who claimed the action would be legal and have some historical reason for being. But the first result was to disrupt some of the arbitrations in process, leading to fighting in Ukraine and Greece. "Who's responsible?" Maya exclaimed to Art. "Is there anyone doing this stuff?" "Of course. Some Metanats have presidents, and they all have executive boards, and they get together and talk things over and decide what orders to give. It's like Fort and the 18 Immortals in Praxis, although Praxis is more democratic than most. And then the Metanat boards appoint the Executive Committee for the Transitional Authority, and the Authority makes some local decisions, and I could give you their names, but I don't think they're as powerful as the folks back home." "Never mind." Of course, people were responsible. But no one was in control. It was the same on both sides, no doubt. Certainly it was true in the resistance. Sabotage against the Vastitas ocean platforms particularly was now pandemic, and she knew whose idea that was. She talked with Nadia about getting in touch with Anne, but Nadia just shook her head. "Not a chance. I haven't been able to talk to Anne since Dorsa Brevia. She's one of the most radical Reds there is." "As always." "Well, I don't think she used to be, but it doesn't matter now." Maya shook her head and went back to work. She spent more and more time working with Nergal, taking his instruction and advising him in turn. More than ever, he was her best contact among the young, and the most powerful, and a moderate to boot. He wanted to wait for a trigger and then organize a concerted action just like she did. And this, of course, was one of the reasons she gravitated to him. But it was also just a matter of his character, his warmth and high spirits. his regard for her. He couldn't have been more different than Jackie, although Maya knew the two of them had a very close, complex relationship, going right back into their childhoods. But they appeared to be estranged these days, which she was not at all unhappy to see, and very much at odds politically. Jackie, like Nergal, was a charismatic leader and recruiting big new crowds into her Boonian wing of Mars First, which advocated immediate action, and thus aligned her much more with Dao than Nergal, politically in any case. Maya did everything she could to back Nergal in this split among the natives. In every meeting she argued for policies and actions that were green, moderate, nonviolent, and coordinated from a center. But she could see that the majority of the newly politicized natives in the cities were attracted to Jackie and Mars First, which was generally red, radical, violent, and anarchic, or so she saw it. And the increasing strikes, demonstrations, street fights, sabotage, and ecotage tended to support her analysis. And it wasn't just most of the new native recruits going to Jackie, but also great numbers of disaffected emigrants, the most recent arrivals. This tendency baffled her, and she complained about it to Art one day after they had gone through the Praxis report. "Well," he said diplomatically, "it's good to have as many emigrants on our side as possible." Of course, when he wasn't online to Earth, he was spending much of his time shuttling around between resistance groups trying to get them to agree, so this was his party line. "But why are they joining her?" Maya demanded. "Well," Art said, waggling a hand, "you know, these emigrants arrive, and some of them hear about the demonstrations, or they see one, and they ask around and hear stories, and some hear that if they go out and join in a demonstration, then the natives will really like them for it, you know? Some of the young native women, maybe, who they hear can be friendly, right? Very friendly. So they go out there thinking that maybe if they help out, one of these big girls will take them home at the end of the day." "Come on," Maya said. "Well, you know," Art said, "it does happen to some of them." "And so, of course, our Jackie gets all the new recruits." "Well, I'm not sure it isn't a factor for Nergal as well. And I don't know that people are making that much of a party distinction between them." "That's a fine point, something you're more aware of than them." She remembered Michelle telling her it was important to argue for what she loved as well as against what she hated. And she loved Nergal, it was true. He was a wonderful young man, the finest native of them all. Certainly it wasn't right to scorn those kinds of motivations, that erotic energy taking people into the streets. Still, if only people could be more sensible. Jackie was doing her damnedest to lead them into yet another spastic, unplanned revolt, and the results of that could be disastrous. "It's part of why people follow you, too, Maya."
"What?"
"You heard me.
Come on, don't be a fool."
Although it was nice to think so. Perhaps she could extend the struggle for control to that level, too, although she would be at a disadvantage. Create a party of the old. Well, in effect, that's what they were already. That had been her whole idea back in Sabishii, that the Issei would take over the resistance and guide it on the right course, and a good number of them had devoted many years of their life to doing just that. But in fact, it hadn't worked. They were outnumbered, and the new majority was a new species, with new minds of their own. The Issei could only ride the tiger, do the best they could. She sighed.
"Tired?"
"Exhausted. This work is going to kill me." "Get some rest." "Sometimes when I talk to these people, I feel like such a cautious, conservative coward of a naysayer. Always, don't do this, don't do that. I get so sick of it. I wonder sometimes if Jackie isn't right."
"Are you kidding?" Art said, eyes wide.
You're the one holding this show together, Maya. You and Nadia and Nergal, and me. But you're the one with the aura. The reputation as a murderer, he meant. You're just tired. Get some rest. It's almost the time slip. Michelle woke her up some other night. On the other side of the planet, Arms Corps security units supposedly integrated into Subarashi had taken control of the elevator from regular Subarashi police, and in the hour of uncertainty, a group of Mars Firsters had tried to seize the new socket outside Sheffield. The attempt had failed, and most of the assault group had been killed, and Subarashi had ended up back in control of Sheffield and Clark and everything in between, and most of Tharsis as well. Now it was late afternoon there, and a huge crowd had appeared on the streets of Sheffield to demonstrate against the violence or the takeover. It was impossible to say. It had no purpose. Groggily, Maya watched with Michelle as police units in walkers and helmets cut the demonstrating groups into segments and drove them off with tear gas and rubber batons. "Fools!" Maya cried. "Why are they doing this? They'll bring down the whole Terran military on our heads." "It looks like they're dispersing," Michelle said as he stared into the little screen. "Who knows, Maya? Images like this may galvanize people. They win this battle, but they lose support everywhere." Maya splayed out over a couch in front of the screen, not yet awake enough to think.
"Maybe," she said.
"But it's going to be harder than ever to hold people back as long as Sax wants." Michelle waved this off, face to the screen. "How long can he expect you to manage that?"
"I don't know."
They watched as the Mangalavid reporters described the riots as terrorist-sponsored violence. Maya groaned. Spencer was at another AI screen talking to Nanao in Sabishi. "Oxygen is rising so fast, there has to be something out there without suicide genes."
"Carbon dioxide levels?"
"Yeah, dropping fast as well."
"A bunch of really good carbon-fixing bacteria out there, proliferating like a weed. I've asked Sax about it, and he just blinks."
"Yeah, he's as out of control as Anne, and she's out there sabotaging every project she can get her hands on." When Spencer got off, Maya said to him, "Just how long is Sax going to want us to hold out?"
Spencer shrugged.
"Until we get something he thinks is a trigger, I guess. Or a coherent strategy. But if we can't stop the Reds and the Mars Firsters, it won't matter what Sax wants."
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 17 of Green Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 18.